Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Non-Statutory Insider Status Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On March 5th, 2018, the Supreme Court decided U.S. Bank National Association versus Village at Lake Ridge, a case involving how appellate courts should review a lower court's determination that a person related in some way to a bankruptcy debtor is an insider, and therefore subject to special restrictions that the Federal Bankruptcy Code imposes on insiders. In 2011, the Village at Lake Ridge filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which seeks to facilitate a reorganization that allows the debtor to maintain viability while restructuring debts. At the time, Lake Ridge owed millions of dollars to its owner, MBP Equity Partners, as well as to U.S. Bank. Lake Ridge's proposed reorganization plan placed both creditors in separate classes and would have impaired their interests. U.S. Bank objected, which precluded a consensual plan. But under the code, MBP's status as an insider, being the owner of Lake Ridge, meant that MBP could not provide the requisite consent to force a cramdown of the plan over U.S. Bank's objections. Lake Ridge was therefore faced with liquidation unless MBP could transfer its claim against Lake Ridge to a non-insider who would agree to the reorganization plan. Kathleen Bartlett, a member of MBP's board, persuaded retired surgeon Robert Rabkin, with whom she was romantically involved, to purchase MBP's multi-million dollar claim for $5,000. Rabkin then consented to the reorganization plan. U.S. Bank again objected, arguing that the transaction was not truly at arm's length due to the romantic relationship between Bartlett and Rabkin. Rabkin was essentially a non-statutory insider. The bankruptcy court rejected this argument, deeming Rabkin's purchase a speculative investment and noting that Rabkin and Bartlett lived separately and managed their own affairs. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed that judgment, concluding that it could not reverse unless the lower court had committed a clear error. The Supreme Court then granted certiorari to address the proper standard of review. By a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kagan, the court held unanimously that the Ninth Circuit acted properly in reviewing the bankruptcy court's determination of non-statutory insider status for clear error, rather than undertaking de novo review. Justice Kennedy filed a concurring opinion. Justice Sotomayor also filed a concurring opinion, which was joined by Justices Kennedy, Thomas, and Gorsuch. And now, to discuss the case, we have Tom Plank, professor of law at the University of Tennessee School of Law.
This case involves what may appear to be a very narrow and arcane issue, but which may nevertheless have practical significance. What is the standard for appellate review of a bankruptcy court's determination that a particular transaction is an arm's-length transaction? De novo review of a legal issue or clearly erroneous review of a factual determination? The context for this determination in this case is whether a person who acquires a claim against a debtor in bankruptcy is a, quote, non-statutory insider, close quote, that would be disqualified from voting to confirm a Chapter 11 reorganization plan. In this case, the Village at Lake Ridge filed for bankruptcy. It had two creditors, a secured creditor with a claim of about $10 million, and the sole member and parent of the debtor held an unsecured claim for about $2.76 million. The debtor filed a disclosure statement and an initial plan of reorganization. The board members of the parent, who managed the parent, decided to sell its claim, and one member of the board, Kathy Bartlett, with the approval of the other members, offered to sell the claim to Dr. Robert Rabkin for $5,000. Ms. Bartlett and Dr. Rabkin had a close business and personal relationship. Rabkin stated that he purchased the claim from the parent as a speculative investment, in part because of Bartlett's assurance that he can make a profit. However, when he purchased the claim, he did not know that the payout under the proposed reorganization plan was to be $30,000. And he didn't have any knowledge about the debtor or its prospects. He also said that due diligence would have been expensive. The purpose of the sale by the parent was to ensure that the debtor's reorganization plan could be confirmed. Under Section 129A and B of the Bankruptcy Code, a reorganization plan can be confirmed over the objection of one class of impaired creditors, a cram down, if another class of impaired creditors votes to accept the plan. However, the votes of creditors who are insiders aren't counted. Under the plan in this case, the secured claim was put in one class and the unsecured claim was put into a different class. It was expected that the secured creditor would vote to reject the plan. Because the parent held the unsecured claim and the parent was an insider under the definition of Section 10131, a vote by the parent would not be sufficient to meet the requirements for a cram down. However, if the parent sold the unsecured claim to a non-insider and the transferee voted to confirm the plan, then the bankruptcy court could cram down the plan on the non-consenting secured creditor. After the sale of the parent's claim to Rapkin, the secured creditor moved to have Rapkin declared an insider on several grounds, including the grounds that he was a, quote, non-statutory insider, close quote. Section 10131 of the Bankruptcy Code defines an insider to, quote, include, close quote, certain specified entities, such as a person in control of the debtor. In this case, the parent was the sole member of the debtor and therefore a statutory insider. But because the definition uses the term includes, the enumerated categories of insiders is not exclusive. And this definition contrasts with other definitions that use the term means, which are exclusive definitions. Therefore, federal courts in bankruptcy have determined that certain entities that are not included in the enumerated list of insiders are nevertheless non-statutory insiders. In this case, the bankruptcy court found that Rapkin was not a non-statutory insider because Rapkin did not exercise control over the debtor, and although they had a business and personal relationship, Rapkin and Bartlett did not live together, did not pay each other's living expenses, and did not buy each other expensive gifts. The bankruptcy court also found that Rapkin did not buy the claim in bad faith. Curiously, the bankruptcy court did not articulate a legal standard for the definition of a non-statutory insider. The secured creditor appealed this ruling to the Bankruptcy Appellate Panel for the Ninth Circuit, and the Bankruptcy Appellate Panel affirmed the ruling that Rapkin was not a non-statutory insider. Accordingly, a vote by Rapkin to confirm the plan would not be disqualified. On appeal, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed the bankruptcy court's ruling. First, the Court of Appeals stated that the definition of non-statutory insider was a legal issue to be reviewed de novo. But the determination of whether a specified person qualified as a non-statutory insider was a question of fact that is subject to the clearly erroneous standard of appellate review. The Court of Appeals first articulated the legal test. A person is not a non-statutory insider unless, one, the closeness of its relationship with the debtor is comparable to that of the enumerated insider classifications, and two, the relevant transaction was negotiated at less than arm's length. The court then held that the bankruptcy court's finding that Rapkin was not a non-statutory insider was not clearly erroneous. The court further explained that the evidence did not establish that Rapkin's relationship with Bartlett, who was an insider, was sufficiently comparable to the enumerated categories of the definition of insider. The court then stated that the bankruptcy court evaluated the fact to determine whether Rapkin's relationship with Bartlett was close enough to make him an insider who was conducting business at less than arm's length with the parent. In a footnote, the court excused the failure of the bankruptcy court to specifically consider whether the transaction was arm's length by stating that the bankruptcy court's entire explanation, quote, is a description of why the transaction was conducted at arm's length, close quote. One judge dissented, arguing that the determination of Rapkin's status as a non-statutory insider was a legal question that should be reviewed de novo. The dissent noted that there was no dispute about the basic facts of the transaction. Instead, the dispute was over whether those facts show that the transaction warrants arm's length. And the failure of the bankruptcy court to discuss this part of the legal test makes the question at least a mixed question of law and fact that is presumably reviewed de novo. The dissent further stated that even as a factual matter, the bankruptcy court's ruling was clearly erroneous. The Supreme Court granted cert solely on the question of whether the Court of Appeals was to review for clear error and not de novo review the bankruptcy court's determination that Rabkin did not qualify as a non-statutory insider because he purchased the parent's claim in an arm's-length transaction. Writing for a unanimous court, Justice Kagan noted that a determination of non-statutory insider requires three separate determinations, each of which is reviewable on appeal. One, the legal test for a non-statutory insider, which is reviewed de novo. Two, the determination of the basic or historical facts of who did what, when or where, how or why, which is subject to the clearly erroneous standard of review. And three, whether the historical facts satisfy the legal test for conferring non-statutory insider statute, which is a mixed question of law or fact at the heart of this case. The court stated that the question of standard of review for mixed questions of law or fact depends on the nature of the mixed question and what kind of court, bankruptcy court or appellate court, is best suited to resolve it. Not all mixed questions of law or fact are alike. If the mixed question requires the court to expound on the law and develop auxiliary legal principles, then de novo review is the appropriate standard. But if the mixed question requires immersion in case-specific factual issues that compel the weighing of evidence, judging credibility, and otherwise addressing multifarious narrow facts that resist generalization, then appellate court should review a bankruptcy court's decision with deference. That is, apply the clearly erroneous standard of review. In this case, the mixed question of law and fact are dependent on whether the transaction was arm's length or, as defined in Black's Law Dictionary, whether the transaction was conducted as though the two parties were strangers. On this point, the court held that this inquiry was more of a factual determination and required very little legal work, and therefore should be subject to a clearly erroneous standard of review. The court's analysis does provide some useful clarification. Although the transaction may appear on its face not to pass the smell test, we don't really know because we do not have all the factual information. If the parent had put out the claim to bid, could it have induced a stranger to purchase a claim? What other economic considerations might affect the transaction? Is there any realistic prospect of devising a more precise or detailed legal test for arm's length transaction? This decision appears to give the bankruptcy courts more leeway. But the best approach by either parties for this kind of an issue may be simply to try to build a better factual case. This may be difficult in bankruptcy proceedings where speed in resolving a bankruptcy case is an important consideration and there are lots of things going on. But in any event, the real ball game will be in the bankruptcy court.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.